Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, celebrating the Eternal City's two patron saints, the Apostles Peter and Paul. We go back to ancient Rome. And we take a peek inside the Pope's private chapel, where Michelangelo painted scenes from the lives of the two saints. Every June 29th, the city of Rome celebrates the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. In the Vatican, that day, the Pope presides a special liturgy in St. Peter's Basilica to bestow the pallium on metropolitan archbishops newly appointed over the last year. The Feast of the Church's two founding apostles is a city-wide holiday here in Rome. Jill Bevilacqua explores the fascination travelers throughout the centuries have had with the Eternal City and its link with Peter and Paul. Let's listen.
If you are at Rome, live in the Roman style.
People out of Rome have no idea how one is schooled here.
Rome was tawdry and so crowded. I hated it.
One would say that the neighboring towns have all breathed the beneficial air of a gentle, pure wind blowing from the direction of Rome.
Plutarch, of course, the first century Greek biographer, was writing in metaphor about Rome in the time of Numa, the priest king, lover of peace. The influence of the gentle Sabine was such
that in men's hearts a desire for a quiet life has been born, to cultivate the land, to bring up their children in peace, to serve and honor the gods. Soon nothing else was seen but games, feasts, sacrifices, banquets. The people got to know each other. They mixed freely with one another without fear, without danger.
Numa Pompilius reigned 7 centuries before Christ. But it's quite likely that the climate of Rome was not so very different from that of today. The winds surely were the same then as now. H.V. Morton tells us about two of them.
The scirocco, blowing all day, had filled Rome with the hot, uneasy smell of Africa. Nerves were short, as they are during the Cape Southeaster, and men popping about on Vespers seemed fit targets for one's exasperation. The marble in the Forum was too hot to sit on. The restaurants were encircled by nauseating whiffs of ravioli, and the asphalt of the Corso had melted into soft treacle. During the siesta, I lay on my bed, watching the incandescent stripes as they palpitated against the slats of the shutters, dreading the moment when I would have to go out into the airless streets again. But when I did so, something marvelous had happened. A soft, gentle wind, the Ponentino, in which I fancied I could smell the sea, was blowing through Rome, and life was bearable again.
Life in Rome in the first century, however, seems to have been something less than bearable. The Spanish-born poet Martial complained of the noise, but then he did have a room with a broken window. But owners of blocks of flats were just as profiteering as those of today, being built at rock-bottom price and far from solid, wrote Martial's friend Juvenal, who came to Rome from Aquila.
We inhabit a town which is largely built of wooden beams, and when the landlord has stopped up the crack in an old wall, he invites the people to sleep in all quietness in the ruin hung above their head.
Juvenal, who lived in near poverty most of his life, declared that it was better to be the slave of a rich man than a poor citizen. rents were high, and the poor occupied the upper stories. An attic might be reached only by ladder, and if the tenant failed to pay his rent, the owner simply withdrew the ladder. This was known as precludere inquilinem, or confining the tenant. Juvenal's satires were directed not only at the idle rich, but at the Roman populace, who were, he declared in a famous phrase, interested only in bread and circuses. Bread being the free corn dole, and circuses the variety of free spectacles offered by the emperors, chariot races, mock sea fights, gladiatorial flights, and the throwing of Christians to wild beasts. If he'd lived in the 4th century, Juvenal would have seen a different Rome, where Christian feast days were a cause for rejoicing. The Spanish poet Prudentius was in Rome on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul.
An extraordinary crowd, festive, rushing. Why, my friend, is it wandering throughout the city, filling it with clamour and jubilation? Here we are once again at the day of the Apostles' triumph. Watch the throngs of Romans in the city squares, some going one way, some another. There are really two feasts, but the joy is one.
From early times, the Feast of the Apostles was kept with great solemnity in Rome, and in the 4th century, it was almost like our Christmas Day festivities. But when St. Jerome wrote to his friend, the Virgin St. Eustochium, to acknowledge a gift of fruit and sweets, he reminded her that the feast should be celebrated rather with exaltation of spirit than with abundance of food. He was probably thinking of the banquets held under the porticos of St. Peter's, originally intended to relieve the poor, but which soon degenerated into excesses. What would Jerome have thought of the festivities of St. John's Day in the square and streets around St. John Lateran, as recorded by the Rome correspondent of the Tablet in 1901?
The day is associated in the mind of every Roman with stalls. Roast pig, cloves, pinks, bells of baked clay and lavender. The cloves are blessed by a cardinal in a cloister of the Basilica on the eve before Vespers, and a small packet of them is given to each member of the chapter. They're used in presses where woolen goods are stored to keep moths away. The lavender, which is not blessed, is used for the same purpose. The pinks serve for ornament, the clay bells amuse the children, and the roast pig is devoured by the proletariat. The feast goes on merrily at illuminated stalls all through the night, and the Romans flock there to witness the scene.
But here, too, the devil managed to spoil things. Writing in Pilgrim Walks in Rome, Jesuit Father Chandlery complained that, of late years, the popular enjoyment has been disturbed by roughs of the lowest type. Few respectable people care now to go and see the merriment. But probably no Roman occasion is more widely known today than the Pope's Urbi et Orbi blessing on Easter Sunday. Charles Dickens was enthusiastic, and the weather was kind.
On Easter Sunday, as well as on the preceding Thursday, the Pope bestows his benediction on the people from the balcony in front of St. Peter's. This Easter Sunday was a day so bright and blue, so cloudless, balmy, wonderfully bright, that all the previous bad weather vanished from the recollection in a minute. I had seen the Thursday's benediction dropping damply on some hundreds of umbrellas, but there was not a sparkle then in all the 100 fountains of Rome, such fountains as they are, and on this Sunday morning they were running diamonds. 150,000 people were there at least, yet there was ample room. How many carriages were there, I don't know, yet there was room for them too, and to spare. The great steps of the church were densely crowded. Below the steps the troops were ranged. In the magnificent proportions of the place they looked like a bed of flowers, and the mingling of bright colours in the crowd was beautiful. Sulky Romans, lively peasants from the neighbouring country, groups of pilgrims from distant parts of Italy, sightseeing foreigners of all nations, made a murmur in the clear air, like so many insects, and high above them all, plashing and bubbling and making rainbow colours in the light, the two delicious fountains welled and tumbled bountifully.
Familiar though the scene is to many of us, it comes to life again in the freshness of the writer's first impression.
A kind of bright carpet was hung over the front of the balcony, and the sides of the great window were bedecked with crimson drapery. An awning was stretched too over the top to screen the old man from the hot rays of the sun. As noon approached, all eyes were turned up to this window. In due time, the chair was seen approaching to the front, with the gigantic fans of peacock's feathers close behind. The doll within it, for the balcony is very high, then rose up and stretched out its tiny arms, while all the male spectators in the crowd uncovered, and some, but not by any means the greater part, kneeled down. The guns upon the ramparts of the castle of St. Angelo proclaimed next moment that the benediction was given. Drums beat, trumpets sounded, arms clashed, and the great mass below, suddenly breaking into smaller heaps and scattering here and there in rills, was stirred like party-colored sand.
The poet and novelist D.H. Lawrence, who travelled in Italy in the early decades of the century, was enchanted by the countryside, but abhorred Italian towns. Rome was no exception.
Rome was tawdry and so crowded. I hated it.
Lawrence, of course, didn't stay long enough to savour the atmosphere of Rome, which the city only offers to those who take time out to discover it. And the advice St. Ambrose gave to St. Augustine all those centuries ago surely still holds.
If you are at Rome, live in the Roman style. If you are elsewhere, live as they live elsewhere.
There are some, though, who, no matter how long they live here, continue to behave as if they were elsewhere. In a book called 6 Months in Italy, published in Boston in 1853, the American author George Stillman Hilliard described the Englishmen in Rome at that time.
In the morning, they may be seen in Monaldini's reading room, poring over the Times, galloping over the Campagna, driving about the streets and never looking to the right hand or the left, or gathering in groups in the Piazza di Spagna to hear the last news from home. In the afternoon, they betake themselves to the Pincio, and for a certain season pace up and down its graveled terrace with vigorous strides, their faces wearing a look of determined resolve, as if the constitution of their country, as well as their own, would suffer if they lost their daily walk.
Perhaps the German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who arrived in Rome in 1786, summed it best when he said,
"Certainly, people out of Rome have no idea how one is schooled here. One has to be born again, so to speak, and one learns to look back upon one's old ideas as upon the shores of childhood."
Both Dickens and Goethe have left vivid descriptions of the Basilica of St. Peter's when lit up at night. Let's join Dickens again on that same Easter day.
When the night came on, without a cloud to dim the full moon, what a sight it was to see the great square full once more, and the whole church from the cross to the ground lighted with innumerable lanterns, tracing out the architecture and winking and shining all round the colonnade of the piazza. And what a sense of exultation, joy, delight it was when the great bell struck 7:30, on the instant, to behold one bright red mass of fire soar gallantly from the top of the cupola to the extremest summit of the cross, and the moment it leapt into its place become the signal of a bursting out of countless lights, as great and red and blazing as itself, from every part of the gigantic church, so that every cornice, capital, and smallest ornament of stone expressed itself in fire, and the black, solid groundwork of the enormous dome seemed to glow transparent as an eggshell. And 2 hours afterwards, when we'd got away and gone upon a distant height and looked towards it, there it still stood, shining and glittering in the calm night like a jewel, not a line of its proportions wanting, not an angle blunted, not a tome of its radiance lost.
Goethe witnessed the lighting up of the dome on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul.
The sky was pure and calm. The moon shone sweetly and poured what was like a luminous vapor onto the flames of the lamps. But at the end, when all became fire, the splendor of the moon was dimmed. It is only when we think that this enormous building at that moment serves only as a framework that we realize that nothing quite like it can be seen anywhere in the world.
Jill Bevilacqua's program from her series, And They Came to Rome. It's one of the private chapels of the popes, located in the Papal Palace, just down the hall from the Sistine Chapel. As the Pope's private chapel, it's normally off-limits to the public and even to Vatican personnel like me. But after restoration work on the Pauline Chapel finished in June 2009, some of us had the perhaps once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go up and take a peek at it, and at Michelangelo's two huge frescoes adorning its walls. The sweep of the nave and the white stuccoed reliefs framing Michelangelo's massive, colorful paintings left me breathless. The chapel takes its name from Pope Paul III, who in 1537 commissioned Antonio da Sangallo the Younger to build it for his personal use and for holding conclaves. Pope Paul asked Michelangelo to decorate the central parts of the two long walls with frescoes. Michelangelo was putting his last touches to the Sistine Chapel when Paul told him to paint the first fresco, the Conversion of St. Paul, which he began in 1542. In an unusual juxtaposition of themes, the Italian master painted the second fresco, the Martyrdom of St. Peter, between 1546 and 1550. By then, Michelangelo was an old man who probably felt like he was being torn in wildly different directions. He was asked to design the grandiose plaza on Rome's Capitoline Hill, complete the Farnese Palace, and upon the death of the architect Sangallo, he was charged by Paul III with designing St. Peter's Basilica. In his book, The Lives of the Artists, his friend and biographer Giorgio Vasari wrote, "These two frescoes were Michelangelo's last." He told me, Vasari wrote, that it took him a great effort to finish them. Of the Sistine Chapel's Last Judgment, Vasari wrote that Michelangelo's masterpiece had rendered to the world
the great exemplar of the grand manner of painting, directly inspired by God, and enabling mankind to see the fateful results when an artist of sublime intellect infused with divine grace and knowledge appears on earth.
As he did in the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo packs the Pauline Chapel frescoes with figures whose muscular bodies are revealed under tightly bound tunics and drapery, their forms so similar to the sculpted figures he loved to draw out from marble.
The best of artists hath no thought to show, which the rough stone in its superfluous shell doth not include. To break the marble spell is all the hand that serves the brain can do.
Here, Michelangelo unveils sculpture-like figures in the Conversion of Paul, who falls from his horse to the ground, struck and blinded by a thunderbolt sent from Christ himself in heaven. The fresco is packed with people who, through their movements, create a sense of depth in a plain green and blue landscape. The city of Damascus, Paul's destination, off in the distance. Facing this fresco on the opposite side of the nave, St. Peter, who is fixed to a cross, about to be raised and crucified upside down. Unlike the lofty figures adorning the Sistine Chapel, so far out of our reach, Peter here is close, staring straight at us. Also here, the scene is packed with people, soldiers and onlookers, even a fellow finishing the digging beneath St. Peter so that the cross can be planted in the soil. I didn't go to the Pauline Chapel by myself. I had one of the best guides you can ask for, the chief art historian responsible for the restoration project, Professor Arnold Nesselrath from the Vatican Museums. I asked him, a bit naively, when the Pope uses the Pauline Chapel. After all, Pope John Paul II preferred to celebrate Mass and pray in the modern Redemptoris Mater Chapel, next to the papal apartments. Where is the Pauline Chapel in the palace, anyway?
Where the Chapel of Redemptoris Mater is on the second floor, i.e. on the floor of the state rooms of the Holy Father, where he receives people in private audience. The Pauline Chapel is on the same level as the Sistine Chapel, and both are connected by the huge Sala Regia, the Royal Hall, or however you want to translate this, i.e. the hall where the Pope meets the, always met the most important visitors, that's why it's the Royal Hall, and where he even always receives, at the beginning of the year, the diplomatic corps to celebrate the beginning of the new year. The Pauline Chapel is the so-called minor palace chapel, while the Sistine Chapel is the major palace chapel. And the major palace chapel does not have a tabernacle, so the Holy Sacrament is kept in the Pauline Chapel. And therefore, the two also have to be connected somehow. You have to be able to get from the one to the other during a liturgical celebration. The Chapel of the Holy Sacrament is one function of the Pauline Chapel. The other for which it was built was that in the Pauline Chapel, in the minor chapel, up to the year 1670, the votes were cast during the conclave. And the newly elected pontifex was venerated on the altar of the Pauline Chapel. That function changed and moved to the Sistine Chapel only in 1670, when the Collegiate of Cardinals became so big that they did not fit into the Pauline Chapel anymore. But the two chapels are closely interlinked, and those were the two functions, and the Chapel of the Holy Sacrament is the function that the chapel still has to the present day.
And how many? You said that the whole College of Cardinals could not fit into the Pauline Chapel at one point. How many people can be accommodated in there?
When a Mass is celebrated in the Pauline Chapel, I think the capacity is up to 80 to 100 people that can sit on the benches that will be put up again in the chapel. But of course, during the conclave, the cardinals would sit along the walls, and that's also a reason why the dado of these walls is so high, so they could put in the stalls with the baldachin, and this function in some way conditioned also the architecture that Antonio da San Gallo the Younger had to design.
The St. Paul and St. Peter frescoes face each other on parallel walls, and we, the visitor, find ourselves stuck in between them. We, too, become part of the dialogue.
The only figure that has eye contact to the visitor is St. Peter. He's the only figure that's looking at the visitor, and he is the Pope, he is the Vicar of Christ on earth, and he's the one through whom the visitor enters these scenes. But there is this interrelationship between the two frescoes, which is not the traditional pairing, but it's the first step, which is the conversion, and it's the second step, which is the crucifixion.
Pope Paul III obviously made a very personal choice when he decided which scenes he wanted Michelangelo to depict. What message did Paul want to get across to the visitor through the conversion of Paul and the martyrdom of Peter? What does one think about standing in this chapel? For me, it seemed as if Michelangelo and Pope Paul were drawing a circle from the beginning of belief in Christ and the spreading of the good word through apostles like Paul to the end, the ultimate sacrifice, the willingness to give up one's life for that belief, and the knowledge that that belief will continue to the end of time.
I'm sure this is important in this. Now, we mustn't forget this is a chapel where the new pope is being elected. And during the election, the Collegiate of Cardinals is accompanied by the two princes of the apostles, of whom one becomes the vicar of Christ, not the other one. That's what's also then happening to the cardinals who choose one from their middle to become the new pope. And then it's a question of who sees, because Paul is blinded by conversion and Peter is seen through martyrdom. So there is also a process here that goes across from one fresco to the other and then ends up with a visitor that's chosen by Peter to be looked at.
Exactly, because one thing that does hit you when you won't go into that chapel is Peter is staring directly at you.
Yeah, and this is an experience that each visitor has who comes into the chapel. Now, that's also, of course, an experience that every cardinal had who entered the chapel when they were going to elect a new pope. And I think this is something that's also very important for the understanding of the two frescoes in this context, and then those are the two who guarantee also the respect for the Holy Sacrament.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath is the chief art historian from the Vatican Museums, responsible for overseeing the recent restoration of the Pauline Chapel. A very warm thanks to him. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.